Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your broken orbit of music news and cultural commentary. I'm Ben Ratliff, your host.
Every breaking wave on the shore tells the next one there'll be one more. And every gambler knows that to lose is what you're really there for. Summer else fears.
You're listening to Every Breaking Wave by U2. John Pareles, you were just with U2 in Vancouver.
Indeed, I was.
Vancouver is where U2 is rehearsing for their tour, which is about to start May 14th.
Right.
We'll come to New York City in July. It's a 68-concert tour, not the Gigunga size spots, but merely the arenas.
Merely the arenas and 5-6 nights at them in places like L.A. and New York.
And obviously, we did a podcast about U2 not that long ago.
We fought viciously about this album.
We did. We had a little disagreement. But what's happening here is they're touring after a record that I guess we can say didn't do very well, but what does that mean?
Well, you can't really tell how well it did. I mean, that's what's baffling, I think, them and everybody else. The tour sold out like 98% of its tickets, so
Right. Clearly
people don't hate them as much as the internet would tell you they do.
Well, I mean, we have to say here that U2 holds the record, no? For the highest grossing tour?
Well, in part because that stadium tour allowed them to sell more seats in stadiums because it was in the round than anyone ever touring stadiums could do. So there were literally more seats to sell. So that's how they set the world record with the 360 tour.
Right. Okay. So the 360 degree world tour, 2009 to 2011, it earned them $730 million. That was a success.
That was a success, I think.
Also, just to put things in perspective, U2 is one of the big three, shall we say three, of the still standing, enormously selling rock bands.
Who are you putting the
Rolling Stones and AC/DC.
Eagles?
Well, in terms of record sales, yeah. But like record sales plus tours, I don't know. Maybe we should put the Eagles in that category. In any case, the U2 has sold a lot of albums too.
Yes, they have a lot of fans.
Yeah,
they have a lot of established user base.
Right, they've sold 150 million records. Only 150 million.
I'll take it.
Compared to the Stones, who have sold 240 million. In your piece about U2, you know they're coming off this mixed experience of the record Songs of Innocence was deposited into the inboxes of perhaps 500 million people. 26 million are known to have downloaded it, although some of those people may have automatically downloaded it.
Because it was in their purchased queue.
Right, because it was in their purchased queue, not of their own volition. They still sold more than 100,000 physical copies of the record.
Right, even though everybody in the world had it.
Even though in the world had it. But they're in this funny moment where everybody has been given this thing, but they have no idea whether anybody's actually listened to it.
I mean, I'm sure you can find Spotify plays. I'm sure there was a weird consumer survey that claimed they were the most played band on iTunes in the first months of the year, but it didn't quite convince me. But no, but they don't know, and they don't have regional sales to tell them who bought the album, and they don't have people calling into radio stations to request it because why call your radio station? You've already got the album if you want it.
And this gives them a certain unease or trepidation about how much of the record to play in their tour, basically.
Yeah, right? But they're going to play most of it. They're going to play 7, possibly 8 songs from it.
Really?
Yeah. They're not backing down. I mean, part of this is similar to the 360-degree tour where they doggedly played this album that didn't have a big hit single on it.
We should make that point. The incredibly successful 360-degree tour also came after a record that didn't do very well by U2 standards.
Well, it sold a million copies still. So, I mean, U2 really wants to get people singing along. It really does have this idealistic sense of community. It's not all about grosses and T-shirt sales. I really do think they want to unite the world in some way. They want that sense of community. They're like Bruce Springsteen, their contemporary. There's a mission there. besides selling tickets, besides selling albums. I mean, it really consumes them. It upset them that they did not have a hit single that everybody was singing. And for that tour, they did their best to put that album across. And as the tour went on, more songs from it disappeared and more surefire oldies went in. But they don't want to be an oldies act. I like seeing the Rolling Stones on tour still. We watch Charlie Watts and Keith Richards. But they know they're an oldies act. They tour, the last tour, they put out two songs. Mm-hmm. And they played the oldies that they know people want to hear. U2 really still wants to be engaged with now. Their fans might be happier if they played all oldies, but U2, it rubs them the wrong way to do that.
So you say in your piece that it shook the band's confidence, what just happened.
No Line on the Horizon.
No. I'm talking
well,
about—
Well, both. Both the, No Line the, on the Horizon record. In 2009 and the Apple backlash shook them a bit, yes.
What does that look like? U2 with shaken confidence. I mean, how does it manifest? How do they express it when they're talking to you?
They say, we have something to prove, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And they say they're going out to an audience, playing them songs that they don't know if people have listened to, which is something when you're a big, famous band playing sold-out arenas.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they have something to prove. I mean, the tour was in the works. I mean, that album rollout was supposed to be this well-oiled machine in everybody's inboxes, a week on The Tonight Show, a single comes out, and then Bono has his bicycle accident.
A terrible accident,
and
right?
Smashes up his face, smashes up his shoulder, his arm, his hand. He still has two fingers that don't move. You know, the rollout of the album is pretty much derailed. Every Breaking Wave, which I think is a really solid, wonderful, heartfelt U2 song, kind of fizzled on radio. Because I don't think it had the momentum of the band out there promoting it
mm-hmm.
while Bono was recuperating.
When I heard about the accident, my first thought was, he's going to be hurting for a long time.
I hung out with them for, you know, a day and a half. He's pretty energetic. I mean, he's working the stage, he's singing, and then when they're working on, like, whatever, the video wall, he's, like, back in a little studio in the arena recording. So I heard, like, half a dozen new songs. It's not like he's sitting there moaning. I mean, he jokes that he can't play guitar and that it's not the downfall of Western civilization that he can't. He says the rest of the band doesn't mind that he can't play guitar.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's got a sense of humor about it.
Do you think that what they're doing here is they're doing this big, ambitious, we can talk a little bit later about the stage set and this audio system that they've devised
yeah.
for the arenas, big tour coming off an album that, you know,
well,
may
an
have
album
met some,
has,
some
has a mysterious impact.
Has a mysterious impact, and you know, and the front man is damaged physically. It's slightly against the odds here. Does that energize them?
Yes.
Are they into that?
They're doing double duty.
Is it like a treat for them to be given some odds on a plate?
I think it might be. I mean, I've covered them through the years. They're always pretty industrious, but this thing is really industrious. I mean, they were simultaneously juggling video, trying to figure out how to use their stage. This tour's been in the works since 2013. So it's not like we put out the album, uh-oh, we better tour.
Sure.
Their tour designer showed me drawings that date back to 2013, and they're apparently, you know, hundreds of models of potential stages built.
Well, it's probably part of the songwriting process at this part. They write a song, and simultaneously they imagine how it can be,
how it goes live.
Yeah, how it goes live. You know, what enormous thing can happen live.
Well, I mean, the song that starts the album, Miracle of Joey Ramone, is this big arena chant. It's this big foot-stomping, whoa, whoa, classic U2. And I think they're going to, like, pull it out and see if anybody sings along. And suppose there is silence in the arena when you start this song that's made for 10,000 people to sing.
Why don't we hear a little bit of that song, Miracle of Joey Ramone?
I woke up at the moment when the miracle occurred, and a song that made some sense out of the world. Everything I ever lost now has been returned. The most
That was Miracle of Joey Ramone by U2. And we're talking with John Pareles about U2's tour and the difficulties thereof. As you explain in your piece, it's a complicated stage setup. It's three parts, essentially.
It's this big island in the middle of the arena. And one end is a little round stage, and one end is a bigger square rectangular stage. And in between is a very wide walkway that turns into a third stage.
So the setup is that they're not in front of you. They're cutting through you.
They're getting close to everybody. I mean, everybody has these satellite stages now. U2 was one of the first, they claim.
Sure.
When I walked into the arena and I saw, you know, okay, stage in the front, stage in the back,
yeah.
Fine. That's pretty standard. Having the walkway be a third stage with this video wall is a little different.
Right.
But the really different thing is the sound system.
Right, which also renegotiates the spatial organization and the relation of the listener to the sound.
They were thinking, you know, we're going to be all over the arena. Our sound should be all over the arena. They put basically an oval of 12 groups of speakers in an oval around the ceiling. There's no big column of sound on the stage. There's not one of those overhanging things in front trying to blast all the way to the back.
Yeah.
There is an oval of sound pointing down equally at every listener. It sounded great to me. I got to say, I mean, the arena was empty. An empty arena should be like an echo chamber.
Right.
And I walked around the place and it was clear. You walk up to the stage and it's not any louder than it is from the other end. So everybody in the room is getting pretty much the same sound.
Does it minimize echo because it's not so much volume coming just from one single part?
That's what I would guess, yes. I'm not an acoustical scientist, but it doesn't have to be as loud because you're not blowing sound from the front of the arena to the whole back of the basketball court. You're just pushing sound down to a listener who's under a ceiling.
Did they consider giving every member of the audience Apple earbuds?
And making it wireless? Could be a little tangled.
I've
actually been to a show that did that, which is kind of cool. I think it was a Stereolab show. It was great listening through headphones.
Did you take them home?
I did not take them home. Hmm. They were wireless. You don't want to plug in 20,000 wired headphones. That could be a lot of cords.
Right.
But I just think this is brilliant. It's like, why didn't anybody think of this before?
It does sound incredible. Yeah, it does sound incredible.
I mean, it's so obvious, but we have the whole paradigm of you're in the club with the band on the stage for, what, decades? That's been carried into arenas.
Well, it's sort of like the output sound system too, right? You know, in the club output where there's all these little speakers all over the place, just sort of slightly above your head.
Yeah.
As you're walking around.
It's a club idea.
My immediate thought when I read about this amazing new sound system arranged on the ceiling was, is it a one of a kind?
I think it's, yeah.
They've bought it. You know, it has to be stored somewhere.
Well, but everything, I mean, every band is, nobody takes an arena tour off the shelf, pretty much.
Right.
I mean, people build their own sound systems regardless.
So it's an investment because they're gonna do a few more arena tours.
Yeah.
And is it such an investment that other bands will have to rent these things from U2?
Or build them themselves.
In order for them to pay off.
Well, Gavin Friday, a childhood friend of Bono who's in the Virgin Prunes and is working on this tour, was saying, everybody's going to want this the minute they hear it.
That's interesting.
I would hope. I mean, it was really good arena sound. I mean, usually when I go to Madison Square Garden, if you're in the wrong seat in Madison Square Garden, you don't hear everything once but twice because it's echoing off the exit doors. I hope this will eliminate that because it's not bouncing from the stage onto the architecture. It's coming down with unobstructed to your ears.
Well, it's a true fact that, you know, everything is improving technology-wise in terms of our consumption of music, except for going to a big concert. You know, which for the most part, especially in arenas, is a punishment.
It's stalled, let's say. I do think this advances the game.
Now, let's talk about the record that they're working on. They've done Songs of Innocence, and now they're moving on to Songs of Experience. And as you described in your article, they're recording it as they're rehearsing for the tour, actually in the same spot. They
have a little alcove with a studio,
yeah.
and they're flying in producers. A couple of the guys they're working with are Andy Barlow, who's the electronics in the electronic group Lamb, and Julian Thomas, who's a real rocker guy. you know, No Line on the Horizon was made with their old team, Daniel Lanois, Brian Eno, Steve Lillywhite. The new album was made with a bunch of new guys, Ryan Tedder, Danger Mouse, and they're still juggling producers now. They're really trying to keep themselves awake and engaged.
We have to stress that they don't have to do this, right? Is there a record label saying, come on, guys, we've got to have Songs of Experience in the can by July?
I do not think they're being rushed. And I mean, in fact, this tour probably has like a couple of years to run. Whether they release the album midway through the tour, I have no idea. They probably have no idea.
So what's the concept? I mean, is it they're in action mode and being able to do two things at once fires them up even further?
Well, The Edge said to me, when you're making an album, your songwriting gets better and better as you go because your reflexes are coming back and you're getting more discerning and you're getting all the muscles and reflexes are working.
That made a lot of sense, yeah.
And then you stop and go on tour. And this time they don't want to stop. They want to keep the momentum going.
Mm-hmm.
I'm paraphrasing, by the way. That's not a direct quote. The thing about Songs of Innocence is I think that their mission was totally contradictory. Part of their mission to them was to write classic rock-ribbed pop songs, songs that were catchy. I mean, they said that No Line on the Horizon to them now felt like it was experimental. They were playing with having the songs bubble up out of the sounds. This time they wanted structure first and then, you know, they'd build the sounds around it. You know, they're thinking Motown. They're thinking basic, solid songwriting. But on the other hand, they filled those songs with reminiscences of growing up in Dublin in the 70s, which is not exactly, you know, I love you, I miss you. It's not exactly pop. So they were trying to mash together pop structure with autobiography, with like grown-up people's complicated autobiography, which is a long way around to coming to the songs I heard from Songs of Experience are more straightforward, catchier, terser, and they're talking to you. There's a lot of you in the lyrics. They're arguments with somebody now, and they're sort of love songs, and they're state-of-the-mind songs, but they're not in this autobiographical looking back phase. They're in the present.
And what about sound-wise?
They're snappy, yeah. I mean, I did not hear finished songs. Nothing I heard was close to finish, but they're pushy. I mean, there's one that sounds a lot like The Police. There's one that, you know, that really crisp, terse, short little verses, you know, crisp guitars, sort of the, in a way, the anti-U2, since U2 was all about reverberation.
Right, ringing, yeah.
So they're fighting themselves. I mean, the two guys that I know they're working with, one is a heavily electronic guy, but the song he was working on with Bono, he was cheerleading out a big rock vocal from Bono.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a really guitar-driven riff song. And the other guy is a rocker guy. Regarding our little differences about Songs of Innocence during our previous conversation about U2, Bono said to me that he regretted how glossy the album sounded, that since the period they were remembering was the 70s and early 80s, which was the Ramones and Kraftwerk, the album should have sounded rougher, that it got out and sounded too glossy.
I thought so.
So he agrees with you. So I think this one, they're really trying to rough it up.
Okay, well, we look forward to finding out about the experience of those concerts and the amazing speakers on the ceiling.
I'm looking forward to it. The parts I saw, it sounded great, and I mean, there's also a wall of video that is at one point going to like plunge into those reminiscences. One of the songs on the album, Raised by Wolves, is about terrorist bombing in Dublin in 1974 that killed 33 people. Group of bombings, actually, group of car bombings. The song is called Raised by Wolves, and it's going to be sort of the midpoint of the concert. It's going to have a sound collage sort of recreating the experience of the bombing. So, and then it's going to go into, I think, Sunday Bloody Sunday or something. So you're in the middle of the concert, you're going to have this sort of complete bummer.
Mm-hmm. Sense around.
I mean, this could all change, of course, during rehearsals, but their video wall turns into a barrier that completely separates the audience into two halves. You won't be able to see the other half of the audience in the arena.
Mm.
I mean, part of the whole U2 experience is like you're looking at everybody and they're singing along and you're singing along and it's not going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So Bono said, you know, so this is going to happen and people are going to say, where did the fun go?
And they will look within themselves as they go to the hot dog concession during the intermission.
Could happen.
Well, let's go out with Raised by Wolves from Songs of Innocence by U2. And thanks, John Pareles.
Thanks, Ben.
Face down on a pillow of shame. There's some girls with a needle trying to spell my name. My body's not a canvas. My body's now a toilet wall.
And that's our show. Thank you, John Pareles. Thanks to our producers, Tamara Best and Jeremy Egner and Jocelyn Gonzalez. You can read John Pareles' coverage of U2 and his recent encounter with them in Vancouver at nytimes.com/music. And you can also listen to our Spotify playlist, including some of what we heard here. See you next week.